Okay, welcome back to the Deus Vult Podcast. My name is Father Dan Cale.
I am Father Stephen Felicia.
I hope everyone's doing well out there in podcast land.
Why do you say podcast land?
I don't know. Because people are listening in podcast land.
Are they, Dan?
No, they're not.
I bet kids.
That's fine. I'm
they
sorry.
Listen in the real world.
They do. They listen in great reality. Anyway, so we have the wonderful pleasure to introduce to all of our listeners today our very special guest, our very own Bishop Kevin Carl Rhodes. Bishop, thanks for coming on the show with us.
You're welcome, Father Dan. Great to be here, and Father Stephen.
Bishop. Oh my gosh, it's such
a blast.
I
think it's great to be here. We'll see.
We'll fix it in editing. Don't worry. Surprise. Yeah, we didn't even warn the people this was happening.
No, that's okay.
Did we? Was that intentional?
I don't know. I don't think I thought about it.
Oh. A little surprise.
Well, yeah.
It'll be good.
Here we go.
Yeah.
We've been doing this for, we can't even know how long anymore. We were just talking to you about that, and I was turned to Dan, and I was like, you know what? We should probably ask the bishop to come on. And he's like, you think he would come? I said, I don't know. We might as well ask. And lo and behold, here you are.
It's a nice break from my day. Just to come over here and spend an hour with you guys.
Yeah. Honestly, we think that the same way about the show. Like for us, as much as it's a bit of a sort of an apostolate for us, we're also just like, because we're good buddies, it just gives us an opportunity to sort of decompress and do something fun together that we really enjoy. So we're glad to include you in that.
Thank you. And you even like gave me cookies when I got here and everything.
There's a beer waiting for you when you leave.
And a beer afterwards. I might save that for tonight. You know,
well, no. Yeah, all in your time, Bishop. But shout out to the St. E's Brewing Ministry who provided the beer for our bishop. We do appreciate it.
I've had a bottle of it myself.
Is it good?
I can attest to its goodness. Yeah.
Oh,
I had a bottle.
It's the amber. We're giving you the amber.
Oh, good.
So, okay. Oh, yeah. You said you liked it. So the boys are like, well, give him another one. I said, okay.
Now, do they make that regularly?
So
they brew it?
So how that works, Bishop, is like – We set this up a year ago in the summer, and less than a year ago, it was summer, and we came up with a recipe, and it was actually provided by one of our guys, and we made it for the Seton Fest, which is the big festival for us, and we made about, I think we made 100 gallons.
Wow.
There was a ton of the stuff. We're down to 40 now, and then we make it seasonally, so we just had our recent winter, it wasn't a winter lager. We were thinking about doing that, but then we did a stout. We did a chocolate flavored stout for Christmas.
Oh, nice.
And then we served it as we went caroling. So we also went out caroling into the neighborhoods, and we took a keg all wrapped up in a wagon. And after we sang, oh, yeah, you didn't know this is going on.
No.
This is a thing that happened. And then we would knock on the doors, and after we would sing to the people who opened up, we would offer them either cider or hot chocolate or beer. And, you know, the man of the house sometimes took the beer, and the children would normally take the cocoa, and it was never the other way around. But the
very important distinction.
Yeah.
But no, we made a chocolate stout, and so we have about 10 gallons of that left. It's very popular. And then we also made a IPA, which not the most popular, but some people like it, so it's a thing. And gosh, we had one more. We had a October ale, which we made for Halloween. And I can't remember. We called it like Soul Harvest or something like
that. Oh, gosh.
Something a little tongue-in-cheek. Sorry.
It's a very creative parish project.
Oh, you're very kind.
But you don't sell it then.
No, absolutely. No,
I guess you're not allowed to.
Oh, yeah. Well, no. That's also sort of how we do it. Like, it's a ministry. So, like, we have a welcoming event going on at the parish in the coming days where new families who have joined St. E's we're going to have a dinner or something. And we're also just going to provide beer for free if they want, and obviously of age, like here, this is just something that, you know, is in Father's garage. And mind you, the parishioners made it. And yeah, it's a...
Well, you know, this is a long tradition in the church. The monks, the monastic tradition making beer. Yeah. Brewing beer.
Exactly.
Have you ever had beer from Nursia? The Norsha beer?
I have not.
Okay. Yeah, you can buy that. It's so yeah. I mean, the monks at Nursia are making beer, and it's this really, really good, the rich like double, you know, beer.
And so the listeners know that's where St. Benedict's from, Nursia.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I've been there. Yeah,
yeah. It's beautiful. Did you go? Were you there? You were there pre earthquake.
I was there pre earthquake. yes. Because the earthquake destroyed the church, right?
Where it kind of destroyed the whole town.
Yeah,
like it was really, really rough. But I think they're rebuilding. Kind of. They're trying to build basically a replica church, which is a really a big endeavor. So, yeah. God bless the monks, but I think their brewing business has been fine or it's recovered.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. No, it's a delightful, again, it's something that I don't know. I used to drink. Now I don't drink, but I like the concept of it.
Yeah.
And so it was, I tossed it out to Father Terry. Terry said, yeah, if anybody wants to do it, sure. And then I turned it around and I threw it out to the men of the parish and 12 men showed up and they loved it because they most of them are all now married with kids, and but they still want to brew, but they don't have a good excuse to and time to. But now it's a ministry, so their wives like it because all the beer brewing stuff's out of their house and in the rectory basement. And so everybody's happy. And then we have a libation for the parish. And yes, and the old blessings for beer are still around too. So we can use those. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So there's a whole, whenever we bring it out for a festival or something, we have a blessing ceremony of the beer.
Neat. Now, I didn't know that our episode today was going to be on beer. Should we expand it to like wine and other alcoholic beverages? Is that why I'm...
Would you like to? We can talk about that.
Segues are weird, but yeah. No, I mean, this often happens. So this is sort of the style of the show.
Okay.
As you can tell, it's like... We're just talking about whatever we want to talk about. And then maybe every now and then we'll find like, hey, there's like the little inroad to the thing we actually wanted to talk about. And sometimes we go, I have no idea how to get there. We're just going to start talking.
We just go full stop. Right. Okay, let's talk about the thing. But if we end up talking about Batman at some point, I apologize. It's just a thing that circles in and out of the show.
Well, I loved Batman when I was a kid.
Did you watch the Adam West show?
That was a very popular show. I watched that every week.
No way.
I did, yeah. Batman, Robin, I loved it.
So, like, we have entire episodes dedicated. So, when I was a kid, they had Batman, the animated series from the 90s. And I always, and I go in, so we do episode analysis from time to time. We've done, like, 4 or 5 of them.
Yeah.
And I, like, dissect, like, the morality of Batman in this particular cartoon episode that I watched when I was a kid. It's fun. And
it's like, meant to be a bit of a lighthearted take on a theological discussion. But it's cool. I mean, we have this sort of catchphrase that in the end everything is Catholicism.
Yes.
Like you can sort of make use of it's the principle of test everything and keep what is good.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So
never looked at Batman through a theological lens. Now you have something for me to think about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, if you want some starting points, I can recommend some episode titles. But because you don't have enough, because I'm sure you have plenty of free time.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, did. So, like, it all tied into, like, my life history and things like that. And mind you, like, I'm not completely influenced by Batman. Like, Robert Felicia and Joan Felicia had a significant hand in it, as well as the Catholic Church. But, like...
And the U.S. Army.
Yeah. But, like, incidentally, like, Batman tied into the U.S. Army to some degree, in a small way. But, like, you watch these shows of, like, this, you know, truth, justice, American way kind of thing, and a guy fighting for justice and what is right and you know, to make up for some wrong that was done in the past. And
Who was your favorite villain?
Oh, how come you've never asked me that, Dan?
Well, let's have to have you on more often. Yeah.
My favorite villain, I'm going to have to just go with the Joker. But I mean, like, but Bane is always played in my, but the classic understandable one is the Joker. He's just anarchy. He's gone nuts. And then when you understand like his backstory, which nobody really does, because he even isn't sure, like whenever they would reveal it in the comics or in the cartoons, he'd always claim that this might not be the truth himself, that he's telling you a story. So like he's so confused and mixed up, but it seems that he was a guy who had one bad day. And then went completely nihilistic and then completely anarchistic. And he's unfortunately highly intelligent and he thinks life is a bad joke. And then there's Batman, who's very somber and very
melancholic.
Melancholic and serious.
Yeah.
And yet he understands better than this man who knows how to laugh, like the real value of life. And he's always trying, and he never kills this man. Like, as dangerous as this man is, he is always looking for a way to corral him and to cage him, but not to kill him, because right. what the Joker's abandoned so that he can laugh, like Batman holds on to, even though it hurts him. And like, so there's this beautiful, well, I mean, semi-beautiful dichotomy between like this guy in a, you know, bright purple suit versus this guy who wears, you know, black and very dark shades of gray. And again, like there's, I mean, again, we've even gotten into like the Dante-esque aspects of the fact that like it's a Batman and things like that. This strange, you know, he's always like some sort of creature of hell, and yet he's at the service of the good and things. Anyways,
it's kind of a,
so this is another segue.
Kind of like a living gargoyle, like the purpose of the gargoyle, you know?
Yeah.
It's actually there.
And in fact, they would play with that a lot in the cartoons, where he would be perched on top of a church next to the gargoyles overwatching the city. Uh-huh. And so like, there's a lot of stuff you miss when you're a kid, and like, they're clearly taking, there's a whole episode that involves a Catholic church and a Catholic priest that's very, very good, and a mobster.
Oh, it's really, anyways, good. Really worth your time, honestly. Yeah.
And again, like, you watch this as a kid and you see all this stuff. And mind you, like I said, I don't know. I'm 9 in Fort Wayne, and I'm not studying Dante, but and that's still rotating in my skull somewhere. Yeah. And like, that's building whatever the subconscious version of Stephen Felicia is. And so like, I do have a very strong sense of right and wrong, and I lean into that. And again, like, part of that comes, as we've said before, from my dad. Dad used to be a police officer. And then, when I learned about my dad's past when he was a kid, like, he watched a bunch of Westerns, and Gunsmoke, and Branded, and Roy Rogers, and The Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger was his big one. I think you asked me that once, Dan.
Yeah.
And so I talked to him after that episode or whatever. It's The Lone Ranger. And when, again, a masked vigilante out to ensure that justice is done in a lawless world. And Batman's kind of, in a certain sense, a continuation of that, although, again, like, the settings are different and things like that. But all of that, and mind you, my dad didn't become a police officer because of the Lone Ranger, but I can't help but suspect it had something to do with how Bob Felicia became a man.
Yeah.
And then I'm his offspring. And
I'm just curious, how old's your dad?
76.
Okay. So really, I mean, he would be like 11 years older than me, but some of those shows you mentioned are shows I grew up on.
Sure, sure. Too, I mean, like, they had the reruns or whatever.
Yeah.
And again, it's wonderful to sort of like play with that. And that we can segue into off of that. Mm-hmm. We were wondering, again, like, another huge motif of our show, oddly enough, I was thinking about this when we were like, well, what should we ask the bishop about, is fatherhood. Mm-hmm. Like, again, in part of that plays off the fact that a huge part of like our identity, people call you on a daily basis father. Well, that has to mean something. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So where do we get that? The first place we learn it, of course, is by, you know, hopefully we learn it from the image that our own father had for us, speaking from the human perspective in general. And then obviously it comes to a greater perfection when we realize the father's love, right?
Right.
And everything that can be gained spiritually, real, you know, in a real sacramental way, right, in our hearts after the fact. But you're right, Father Stephen, we talk about family a lot. We talk about fatherhood a lot. And I mean, so much of our day-to-day mission is about, you know, how do we best be fathers for our people. And so a lot of the show, we get into things we want to teach our people. A father's teaching their sons and daughters, right?
Yeah.
So
I mean, if you don't mind, and again, like, we talked about this before, but you're totally free to change course at any time. But would you tell us a little bit about your father?
Yeah,
growing up.
Yeah. Now, very interestingly, my father was born on October 29th, 1929. Does that ring a bell to you? October 29th, 1929.
Halloween is the 31st. So we're off that.
Especially that year.
That's not the market collapse, is it?
It is.
Oh, wow. Man.
Yep. My dad was born on Black Friday.
Whoa.
The day when the stock market crashed and the Great Depression began.
Oh, man.
The very day. So it kind of gives you a perspective, because great poverty resulted, obviously. And And my family, my parents grew up in a small coal region town of Pennsylvania called Mahanoy City. And it was a very, very, you know, ethnic town. There were six Catholic churches for each ethnic group. My family, my mother's side, which was Catholic, attended the Irish church. And that's where I was born, and I was baptized there. It's no longer St. Canicus Church. Hmm. My father was Lutheran. His family was all Lutheran. And you're asking me about my father. His, it was rather poor family. And they were married in 1950. So, cool. But keep in mind, they grew up really in the Great Depression and then World War II, of course. My father served in the Army. And he served in Europe and Korea.
Really?
But Europe after the war.
Sure, sure. But was he in Korea during the conflict?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Whoa. He didn't talk much about it, as many military people don't. I don't think he actually saw active combat.
Well, thank God.
Thanks be to God. When they got married in 1950, at that time, if a Catholic married a Protestant, the wedding could not be in the church. So they were married in the rectory. Mm. My mother's family was very devout Catholic family, as my mother was always very devout. And her mother, my grandmother, I was very close to, and she was like a saint too. But my father's family, they were devout Lutherans. And back in those days, there wasn't really any ecumenism. I mean, there was very little. So there was prejudice unhappiness, especially on the Lutheran side.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How did they meet?
They met in high school.
Oh.
They were like high school sweethearts. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And at that point, when you got married, also both of them had to promise to raise the children Catholic. So before the Second Vatican Council, the Protestant spouse had to make the promise as well as the Catholic spouse. Mm-hmm. Now only the Catholic spouse has to make the promise, and the other spouse needs to know that the Catholic's making that. But anyhow, my father was fine with having us raised Catholic. I think some of his family had some anti-Catholic, significant anti-Catholic bias, but that kind of evaporated over time, as get to know people and things get better. So growing up, my father, as I mentioned, the area was the coal regions, and it became economically depressed because they started closing the coal mines, especially in the 1950s. So there really wasn't any work. So I was just a year old, and they moved about an hour away to Lebanon, Pennsylvania, where I grew up. And he worked for Fort Indiantown Gap. That's an army facility, big army facility. And it's actually where a lot of the Vietnamese were resettled after they came over in the 70s, by the way. But when my father worked there, he was a civilian employee in the area of finance. So that was his job. And he was, we grew up, I would say, lower middle class in the and then kind of moved up to middle class as time went on. But it was pretty simple upbringing in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. We were maybe five blocks from the church, I remember, and the school, we went to Catholic school. So my father was very supportive of our religious upbringing.
Oh, cool.
And he would come maybe on Christmas, Easter, he would join the whole family for Mass. But normally he would go to the Sunday services at the Lutheran church, which was like a block away from the Catholic church. Mm-hmm. In the home, I would say the faith was very present. I mean, the things that were in common when we would celebrate Christmas, there was definitely the religious dimension. We would say grace before meals. My grandmother, my mother's mother came to live with us because she was in ill health, bad arthritis. She's a very holy woman. I learned so much from her, and until I was in eighth grade when she passed away. But my father loved her and it was his mother-in-law, which was really beautiful to see. So there were three of us, my older brother, and my younger sister and I. But basically, our religious formation really came from my mother. My father was, I would say, you know, he still was pretty firm, at least at that time, in his Lutheran beliefs. But he never interfered, you know, like he was a man of faith. Cool. That was very clear. He believed in our Lord, and he would pray. I remember seeing him, both him and my mother, kneeling at the side of their bed at night before they went to bed, saying their prayers.
That's awesome.
So it was a mixed marriage, but it wasn't it was not problematic.
Yeah, I was going to ask, did you sense any sort of awkwardness with that at all? I mean, because I've never, yeah, I don't have a sense of that
right.
sort of experience.
I don't remember well enough. I do remember personally that sometimes when I would go to the Lutheran church, which was not regular, it would be like if there was a funeral or a wedding of a relative.
Sure.
And I was never like real keen on it. I was kind of like, I think especially of funerals. They were celebrated very differently. Mm. For the Catholic funerals, they were very, I would call, very human, very expressive. We would have the body in the home, and there'd be the rosary we'd be praying. There'd be a lot of food, a lot of people. It was very, like, yep. Your grief was very much shared. It was very familial, very communitarian. Mm. And I found it so warm. And then on my dad's side, when there'd be a funeral, it wouldn't have all of that, and there would be a certain coldness.
Really?
So, in a sense, and it was just not something I consciously was reflecting on. It's only in later years that there was that kind of revealed something different between Catholicism and Protestantism in that variety. Is that, you know, there was it was really what we'd call the sacramental sense. Was very the incarnational sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was something I never really could have put into words, but it was the inner experience that I had of Catholicism that really impacted me, and I was able to see the differences on that level.
Would you say that personally that sort of actually strengthened your Catholic faith and your perspective on the church? And
for sure.
Yeah.
For
okay.
sure.
Yeah. The seeing the dichotomy there was enough to strengthen it. Wow. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, wow.
Exactly. And later on, my father drifted away from the Lutheran church and got into some more fundamentalist kind of church. And that was painful because I saw a certain change. But it was kind of a phase, but I was older then. I was probably more at the end of high school, getting into college, but that's a whole nother story. But but that was not how he was when he was, you know, practicing Lutheran. And his family, they were a part of my life too, my grandparents, aunts and uncles and stuff. But I was much closer to my mother's side of the family. So my aunts and uncles and cousins on my mother's side. Now, whether that was because of the Catholicism, I think perhaps.
But it might have been sort of natural.
It was natural too.
Yeah.
It, like all the vacations, I don't think you see this a lot today, but like when I was looking back, my sister gave me a gift for Christmas, which was all the old films of growing up, and she put it on digital, and I was watching that with my family over Christmas break, and it brought back a lot of memories. And as I was looking at that. I mean, it's always so. I mean, there's some of my father's family, but all of the vacations, all the significant events like baptisms, first communions, confirmations, we're all together.
Yeah,
all the cousins, all the aunts and uncles. My mom's side, that there was this extended family that was so impactful in my growing up. Like my first cousins, some of my first cousins are like brothers and sisters to us.
Yeah.
And we still feel that way.
Sure.
And I think that's also maybe part of the faith. There was that real closeness with the extended family.
Yeah. Yeah. My family actually recently did the same thing with digitizing our old family videos. Uh-huh. And it is really impactful just to look back and see like my dad and all of his friends working on our house and growing up and seeing that old stuff. But but seeing how and remembering the things that have impacted you all these years that you have totally forgotten, right? Exactly. But that still are a part of who you are.
Yeah.
Right. And have made you who you are today. So it's like the living memory of those things is your very person almost. Yeah. But
and the whole cultural aspect of our faith that was very much there. For example, when I was watching the videos of our first communions, our confirmations, it did bring back to mind not only how it was a real communitarian celebration that everyone was involved, but also the beauty of it. I mean, I look at the First Communion videos and the confirmation. I mean, just it brought back some of my, like, how I know I was, my spiritual and religious feelings at that time became more evident. It brought back to mind. Yeah, I remember I grew up in a very beautiful church. It had a Gothic church in downtown Lebanon. And growing up, we would, you know, we'd never go downtown without stopping in and making a visit to the Blessed Sacrament. I remember walking in and we'd always kneel and pray at the statue of the Pietà. And this was so much a part of our life, besides Catholic schooling as well. But one of the things that came to mind as I saw my first communion that I thought was so beautiful is I even remember now the closeness I would feel to Jesus after receiving Holy Communion. Mm. Now, this is in the 60s, so we were still at the communion rail. We would, when we would come back to our pew and kneel down, we would put our hands over our face.
You were taught to do that?
We were taught to do that.
Wow.
So you weren't distracted, so you could close your eyes, but you'd put your hands over your face.
Oh, wow.
And you would pray for a while. And I just remember, I mean, it was a beautiful memory that I haven't thought about for years, of how powerful that was for me, that I had just received Jesus. And in my faith, I knew it was him. And I knew he had come within me. And that was just such a beautiful memory that I think, you know, I'm grateful for. And I can only imagine, you know, I'm hoping with the Eucharistic revival, we can bring some of that back of that, that real sense of communion with the Lord after receiving the Eucharist at Mass.
Oh, all about that.
Yeah.
You know, this was something that struck me in preparing for a homily for one of our school masses here. I was talking about, I think I was talking to a group of the older grades because they would have been able to more understand it. But the idea that the truth that every vocation, sort of like the classical vocations, you know, religious life, priesthood, married life, especially those, they're all a participation in some aspect of Christ in sort of an iconographic way, right?
Yes.
So like the priesthood is a participation in sacrifice and the one priesthood of Christ in the ministerial way. Married life is an image of Christ, the bridegroom and the bride, the church, right? So these different things sort of giving them like, look, like, if you are united to Christ, if you are able to follow Him and seek out the will of God, then He will make you into Himself in a certain special way, according to your vocation, according to your call. And so, you talking about your experience of your reception of Holy Communion as a boy in your growing up years, like, it's indicative to me, at least as your son, as one of your priests, to see your vocation come to light, sort of in a bit of a prefigurement there.
Yeah.
By your own reception of Holy Communion, and I think that's to say that like our reception of the Eucharist, are you being united to Christ, sort of that the Great Communion. You know, you're talking about the communitarian aspect of like family life and parish life, but it's also being all united to Christ, right?
Yeah.
That led you, I'm sure you could pop right into your vocation story from that. And
right.
and easily tell us about that, but necessarily, but just to say to our listeners, like, that's the road. Like, if you follow Jesus in the Eucharist and you learn to love him there, then he will absolutely show you your vocation. He will absolutely show you the way to go. So
it did. It definitely paved the way. As I look back on it, I think when I started, I mean, I was also an altar boy, and I don't remember what year that was, but it was probably fourth or fifth, whatever age they allowed it. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, the early masses going sometimes in 6:30 a.m. or whatever. And I do have a good memory of that. But also in the home, I remember, you know, the faith was so much a part of the family life, even though it was a mixed marriage. But like with my grandmother there, she, you know, suffered a lot with arthritis, and the priest would come first Fridays and bring her Holy Communion. And that was always, I mean, we would receive him at the door. It would be very solemn, very beautiful, and her faith in receiving the Holy Eucharist. And then during the day, I mean, the many rosaries she would pray and novenas, and that really rubbed off on all of us too. And my mother was a woman of great faith too, and, you know, started, I don't remember when we were real young, but definitely by the time I was in high school, she was attending Mass every day.
Oh, wow.
So there was that. That was, I remember even sitting at the feet of my grandmother, and she would be talking about the faith, and it was beautiful. I mean, so I had a lot of that. And as I said, my father was very open to that. I mean, but he himself didn't have the same faith. And then I remember confirmation, and I remember that very distinctly, because I mean, back then, I mean, the huge classes, and I mean, talk about the 60s, this was like the heyday, and it was Second Vatican Council. I was born in 57. So by the time, I mean, I was, it was the liturgical changes started probably, you know, 65 onward. Things kind of went crazy by the 70s. So my experience in high school was different, but there was still this great sense of devotion that was there. But then we entered into a time of confusion and liturgical experimentation and all that in the 1970s, which were obviously problematic. But I will say, in my case, it didn't hurt my faith because it was so deep within me.
Mm-hmm. Sort of highlighting the importance of the domestic church there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think, you know, with especially when I was in high school, you know, things were a little wild, especially with the liturgy. But then when I went to college, I started to kind of recapture, I would say, you know, the unchangeable things about our faith.
Mm. You went to college before seminary?
Yeah, 2 years. Got 2 years at Mount St. Mary's, though.
Oh.
Yeah. But that's so the hilarious. Seminary was next door, but I was, but a lot of my intellectual questioning and all that, it's natural in young adulthood at that age, was taking place when I was a freshman and sophomore of college, but they were I was getting a lot of my questions answered, and that was really good. And then, you know, junior year, I went to seminary. I bring that up because, in a sense, what I had learned as a child, kind of in a much more intellectual way, came to me in college. And my embrace of the faith on the level of the issue of reason, for example, the intellectual part, that came into play much more at that time in my life.
It was solidified.
It solidified it.
Yeah. What did you study in those first couple of years of college? Was it theology or was it?
No. Actually, the two theology courses I had were not good.
Oh, no.
So that was not. That's but you know bad. What was good was the philosophy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So that's good to hear. The deeper questions about the existence of God and all of the things, we had really excellent philosophy. Some of the, both ancient, medieval, we studied, and that was really good.
Yeah.
And my prayer life deepened during that time too. I had actually a priest from the seminary that I started to see about what I was discerning the priesthood. And my main block that was really marriage versus celibacy. But once I was able to be at peace with the idea of celibacy, then I was ready to enter. But that took a while.
Would you have considered that spiritual direction or something else?
Yeah, it was. It probably, I don't know that we actually called it that, but it was.
Okay.
Because I would, actually, I remember the priest, Father Minocchio, taught me how to pray with scriptures.
The Minocchio Mart.
Yes.
That's what the room is named after.
Okay, for context, listeners. at Mount St. Mary's Seminary, there is a room dedicated to, it's basically a swap shop for anything clerical goods or books or anything that, that guys maybe have either grown out of, too many Mounties, the breakfast sandwiches, or like their
not
books.
Canadian police.
No, not Canadian police.
Go on.
Or books from previous classes or whatever. It was a place where it was a big catch-all, and if you needed something, you could go there and look and perhaps they would have it. But it was named after this sort of unknown figure, Monsignor Minocchio. Monsignor?
Father.
Father Minocchio. Sorry. The M's.
You didn't even know much about him?
No, we only knew the place where we could go and find a new tabby if we needed it, you know?
Oh, my goodness. They should keep his memory better than that.
I guess so.
I mean, his name hasn't died, and here it is. Now it's immortalized on the internet.
That's right.
What was he, again?
He was a diocesan priest. I want to say Newark, but I'm not. It was somewhere in northern New Jersey. I think it was the Archdiocese of Newark or Patterson or one of those. But he was a very prayerful man, and he had great devotion to the Eucharist, great devotion to Our Lady, and he kind of helped me to develop a habit of daily prayer that was more significant than what I had had, and that was really neat. I remember he would give me scripture passages to meditate on, and I hadn't heard about doing that, like what we would call what's called lectio divina.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that, but at the same time, the devotions that I did have were deepened. For example, the Holy Rosary. I mentioned my grandmother. I mean, that was very prominent in her life. And it just so happened that it was while I was up at the Grotto of Our Lady of Lourdes, which is, for the listeners, that's above the college, above the seminary and the university, beautiful out on the mountain, this grotto replica of Our Lady of Lourdes, the oldest one in the United States, by the way, older than the one at Notre Dame.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
I told them that at a mass once, you know, because I try to keep Notre Dame humble.
Yeah,
it wasn't the oldest.
That's great.
But I was praying up there one October afternoon, and I was praying the rosary and asking Our Lady's intercession as I was struggling with the vocation. And I can actually pinpoint that was the moment of grace, because I was flooded with a peace and a joy that made me understand that, God was calling me to the priesthood. So it's interesting that Our Lady, maybe my grandmother too, was part of that.
What year was it that you were on the edge of going to seminary,
To ask? I started at the Mount in 1975, so this would have been my sophomore year. Now, by the way, that was interesting. I started September of 1975. 2 weeks after I was there, Mother Seton was canonized.
Oh, wow.
So I was there during that in Rome, but with big celebration.
Oh, sure. Well, right next door is the shrine, is where her main relics are. Yeah.
And then, so that was fall of 75. So it was fall of 76, October of 76. That I, quote, heard the call while I was praying up at the grotto.
Wow. That grotto, there, you know, it is something special, because I don't know. You hear stories. I mean, this is another great one here, but like Blessed Stanley Rother, you know, going up to the, I mean.
He was nearly stung by bees to death up there.
You know, more than his work as a maintenance man for the grotto, but like when he returns, you know, from Guatemala.
He goes on retreat up there. Yeah,
and he sort of receives the call to martyrdom, basically. From
the shepherd cannot run.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly right.
Did you ever hear the story while you were there about a former rector of the seminary, Monsignor Mulcahy, and his experience at the grotto?
No.
No.
Oh, let me share that with you.
Please.
I was, you know, I think most listeners know I was rector at Mount St. Mary's eventually, but I never attended there as a seminarian. But there was a Harrisburg priest, Harrisburg being my home diocese, who had been a rector before me. His name was Monsignor Mulcahy. And so after he finished as rector, he went back and became the pastor of the St. Patrick's Cathedral in Harrisburg. Mm-hmm. Well, when he was very ill and approaching death, one of his last requests was to pray back at the grotto.
Wow.
So they brought him in a stretcher, I guess, in a ambulance. I don't know how they brought him there.
Wow.
So they brought him there. This was one of his last wishes. So laying on the stretcher, praying in front of the grotto, and they saw on his face this look of like wonder and a look of awe as he was looking up at the grotto. Mm-hmm. And so people were kind of like puzzled, and like, so when they were leaving, they said, Monsignor Mulcahy, what was your experience just now? And he said, that's the most beautiful Mary has ever looked. Well, the statue of Our Lady of Lourdes wasn't there. It was an empty niche because they had taken the statue to get painted. So
that is awesome.
So did he see her? You know, that seems like what happened.
That is awesome.
You never heard that?
No. We've been told the story that the Pentagon pays to light up the lady on top of the pillar.
Right.
We hadn't been told that one, no.
Wow. Jeez. We'll have to resurrect that lore. We'll just send it back with our guys and tell them to spread that a little bit.
We'll pass that along.
Yeah,
that's
please
awesome.
Do. Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the wings of the seminary, of course, is named after.
Well, again, we don't know why or who he is, but it's named after.
Now we know. Now we know some more.
Yeah.
Now we know some more.
Yeah.
I guess it would make sense to ask a former rector about the previous rectors a little bit.
And right.
I think I would think that you maybe would know some of your predecessors.
Okay. What's it like being a rector? Just on the fly. This is a segue, but here we go.
Well, I mean, it was kind of a challenge. I mean, I was pretty young, and I had just served as a pastor of St. Francis Parish in Harrisburg, inner city parish. And for a year, they had asked me to come and just be an adjunct to teach a course. They needed a course taught that they didn't have anyone to teach. So I was only an hour north of the Mount. So, and I kind of, you know, I had the degrees, and I think it was in canon law, but I can't even remember.
Fine, whatever.
So anyhow, I did that for about a year. And then the Archbishop of Baltimore asked my bishop to release me to be full-time on the faculty there. So he did. It was around that time that my mother died, by the way, in 94. But then in 95, I started full-time. And those 2 years as a professor there were, I always say, they were the two easiest years of my whole priesthood.
Really?
Yeah. Because I had challenging, tough assignments.
Oh, I remember hearing you say some of this in the past.
And that was kind of like the easiest. But anyhow, I just had to teach. I was a formation advisor. I was a spiritual director.
I wonder what your students thought of that time, though. just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We'll fix that in editing.
I was kind of known as a little bit tough as a teacher, but they liked my class.
Tough but fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tough but fair.
Well, we had profs like that who were tough customers, but knew their stuff, and we appreciated it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it. I mean, to me, it was able to get – I kind of got back. That's part of me is the academic side, so I got back into that. But in that second year, you know, the rector was going back to his archdiocese, Monsignor Rolchin, very good and holy priest, back to Washington. So now I was the youngest member on the faculty. I was 39. Huh. And I was really surprised that the board and the cardinal and the president of the university and everybody, you know, who makes the decision makers asked my bishop or asked me and my bishop that I become rector. I said yes. And then in July of 97, I began as rector. I didn't really have much experience. What experience I have? I had been a parish priest. I had been a professor for 2 years. But as far as... But
you didn't really have an administrative role up at that point, had you?
Never.
Yeah.
No. Well, as a pastor I had, but not at the Mount.
But at the seminary,
no,
right? Yeah.
No. Well, I think that second... No, I shouldn't. I should take that back. Monsignor Rolchin asked me to be like an assistant rector of some sort. But I was still full-time faculty, and I don't remember that there was really much I did as an assistant rector. I think I was probably at some meetings and learned a little bit, but I really wasn't. So I really had to learn on the job.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And then I was there as rector for 7.5 years after those first 2 years. So 9.5 years total then was named a bishop. But those were good years. I look back. But it was a learning curve. I mean, definitely. And it was also a little challenging being the youngest because not everyone was necessarily happy that mm-hmm. – most were fine. But
yeah.
Not all were like, well, he's, you know.
So you would have been there – would you have been there in 01?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh.
Tough year, 01.
The toughest.
Yeah.
I'll never forget, I was interviewed by the New York Times. It was a big article about, you know, being a rector of a seminary when the clergy sex abuse.
Yeah.
I presume that's what you're referring to.
Well, there's all kinds of stuff, but yeah.
Yeah.
There's, but we had to go to September 11th, but yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's this is what I was referring to.
That's exactly what I was referring to.
Yeah, with sort of the secondary thought of, and there was also this like,
it was a tough year.
What was going on in the world?
right.
It's a bad year.
Forget about it. Right.
You know, thankfully, we had a very like the Mount was well regarded as far as how we in the formation that we were giving in celibacy. We were faithful to the church's moral teachings, so we didn't tolerate any kind of sexual misconduct and stuff like that. So it was kind of good that we were the ones profiled by the New York Times,
thank
I think.
God.
Yeah. Yeah. As a sign of virtue. Yeah. Oh. That's good.
Yeah.
Did you, I know that there were some priests in our time, wasn't it Monsignor Frontiero?
Yeah.
Who had gotten himself to ground zero when 9/11 happened.
Yeah,
too.
No, that's
and,
right.
He was
involved with the UN or something, or he'd been down there.
Yeah, he was in the area.
And and buildings came down, and him and a couple other priests, and he doesn't talk about it. Went as close as they could get to ground zero and started anointing people.
Wow.
And yeah, no, brave priest. He was a vice rector for a while. Right. You probably know him.
Oh yeah. Good guy.
And yeah. Oh yeah, we liked him. He's I don't know what he's up to now. I think he left the Mount a couple years ago.
I think he's
pastor.
I want to say he's rector at their cathedral actually. Oh,
in New Hampshire, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about that.
But anyways.
But so you were at the Mount when the towers came down.
Yeah, I remember it because we all remember, I guess, where we were at that mm-hmm. time. I was having appointments with seminarians, like one on one. I would always have a one-on-one with each seminarian. And so I was in the middle of that. And I remember there was the secretary came in and said that a plane had hit. So I remember we stopped and we went and watched it, what was going on. And it looked like just an accident.
Sure, of course, at the time.
So after that, then I went back to my office and then met with the next guy, you know, not realizing how serious this was. And then, of course, was interrupted again. And
it became very plain. This was something much different.
Yeah. And then I remember we gathered in prayer. We had a big mass, the whole campus, the seminary and the college. And at that time, it wasn't a university, so I say seminary and college. and it was really, you know, we always had a – even before I was rector, we were having a daily holy hour, so that was very important. But then that evening, we gathered again, and I do remember that. Yeah,
yeah.
Tell me about again. Like I'm jumping all over the place here, but the
I mean, honestly, it's kind of nice. Honest, like selfishly. I mean, even before the listeners get to hear this, it's just nice. It's good for us to get to know you a little better too, and see some of your experiences. But
tell me about the Holy Hour, because like that's been a huge deal for my own spiritual life and that sort of thing. I remember making spiritual hours up in Alaska and the impact that had on sitting here now wearing this, talking to you.
Yeah.
But the how did you discover it, or how did that come about?
No, that's a great question. Well, already when I got to the Mount, not as a college student, but as a faculty member and rector, they already had a daily holy hour on the schedule and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I continued that, obviously. But I'd like to go back a little bit about my experience. I remember as a child, exposition and benediction of the Blessed Sacrament. And I remember that being rather common. And I don't remember it being called a holy hour, but I do remember we would have it and we would pray. I do remember 40 hours, very strong devotion, especially in Pennsylvania because of St. John Newman. That was always a huge event in our parish.
My dad still talks about stuff like that from the 50s,
Yep. And for some reason in Harrisburg and I think Eastern Pennsylvania, I mean, that tradition has continued up till today. For example, when I was a priest and a bishop in Harrisburg, every parish has 40 hours every year.
Wow.
Which, of course, I've just instituted for our diocese beginning this next fall. And
I'm really excited about that, by the way.
Yeah.
Because being at the Mount, we would go, we were in seminary with Harrisburg guys, and they would say, you know, we got 40 hours this parish, I'm going to go help with it. And I'm like, what's 40 hours? You know? and then hearing them talk about it, it's like, oh, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
This is a big deal. So, thank you.
And I think it continued. It didn't continue in Fort Wayne, South Bend. I don't know when it kind of died out here, but I think it probably continued in Pennsylvania because of St. John Newman. And he's the one who brought it to the United States.
Oh, okay.
And he was the bishop of Philadelphia, but he was, at that time, the territory of Harrisburg Diocese was part of Philadelphia. So this was so deeply ingrained. but fast forward, I think when I got to high school, I think that kind of that devotion waned, not the 40 hours in Harrisburg, but exposition was less. There were some who just priests were kind of confused, and I think some theology was even against it, you know, saying, well, no, the Jesus Institute of the Eucharist, it's a meal, and so they downplayed the mystery of the real presence, and some were against having exposition. So when I got, but then when I went to seminary, I remember St. Charles Seminary in Philadelphia. I was there 2 years after I left the Mount. Very strong Eucharistic devotion. We had a weekly holy hour, no, twice a week. And the Mount didn't have daily holy hour at that time, by the way. But St. Charles did. So I had, that was beautiful because it, that devotion then deepened in me. I was sent to Rome. There was no exposition at the North American College, the American Seminary in Rome. And I was kind of disappointed because this had become part of my spiritual life at St. Charles. So I remember I was just a first-year theologian asking, you know, about it. And they just said, no, we don't have that. And so I asked them, by the way, John Paul by that time had been Pope for 1 year. I was doing my own reading, kind of an upstart seminarian, about this and saw the Vatican documents and what John Paul was saying. And I said, we should have Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament here. And so I asked about it. I had some position in student government. I don't even remember. And so some of my friends and I, like-minded, we started to ask, and you know, could we have it? And the faculty was not really keen on it, the rector, but they weren't saying absolutely no. They wanted more dialogue. So then what happened is a group led by one of the fourth year men, a deacon, organized against it. So here I was, first year theologian against a fourth year theologian. Over exposition. And it went on like the whole year, and I'm using church documents, and especially John Paul was very much promoting it. So we kind of won. I say kind of because they began to allow one holy hour a month. It always makes me laugh because that was a big achievement. And I think about guys today, like daily holy hour, and they just take it for granted. And and here I was kind of like, wow, we were successful in this. That looks like, sounds like very little, but in the context. And then
small trickle to a big stream though. I mean,
right.
Yeah. It doesn't,
but let me tell you something humorous that happened after that year though. Maybe not so humorous, but
that depends.
But, I was, my evaluation back to my bishop by the rector was that they thought I probably did not have a vocation to the diocesan priesthood.
Oh my gosh.
But that I was being called to be to a monastery, to the monastic life.
Because you liked any level of contemplation at all.
I think so. I mean, I was like, I just looked at, I was like, oh my goodness, I don't feel any attraction to monastic life. How did that? And then I realized why they put that in there.
Wow.
But luckily, I talked to my bishop and he started laughing too. So,
oh, thank God.
But good. But then the North American College, you know, years later, you know, they have, you know, good Eucharistic adoration there. But
oh, I'm sure.
But you guys don't realize what it was like. This is the 70s again. So especially this is 79 when I got to Rome. So so even within the shadow of St. Peter's, you know, you had this. But it was, well, yeah, I could go on. We could have a whole nother episode.
On maybe we will.
On what priestly formation was like. But priestly formation improved through those years. Well, got much better
when was,
Pastoris Dabo Vobis, 1992.
That was when I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. John Paul wrote this great apostolic exhortation on priestly formation that came out in 1992. And that was really helped seminaries across the world.
Yeah.
I'm sure clear doctrine and theology of the priesthood and the spiritual life of the priest.
I'm sure the build up to that document and then the wonderful waterfall after the fact was just really uplifting for a lot. I think that's why you get a lot of priests who were ordained in the 90s calling themselves the JP2 generation, right? As far as for priests. Yeah.
But I was in the early part of that because I was ordained in 1983.
Okay.
But I would say already, not the majority of my classmates, no, but a minority of us were already what you could call JP2 priests.
Fascinating. You were a JP2 priest before it was cool?
Before it was cool, yeah. And I also, I was a great admirer of Cardinal Ratzinger.
Yeah.
Which wasn't popular among many at that time.
Right.
But
nicest guy in the world.
Too. Oh yeah, so gentle. I remember one visit. Well, this was when I was at Casa Santa Maria, and there were some of the priests who were there who would never wear clerics. They would be in suit and tie, and they disliked Pope John Paul, and they wanted ordination of women. They had a lot of an agenda of different things, and but they were a minority by that point. This is like later in the 80s.
Gotcha.
But Cardinal Ratzinger came and they were kind of disrespectful and I was appalled, but they would ask these stupid questions but he would never be unkind or even if they were a little insulting, what he would do was take whatever question, and I just marveled that they asked, and he would go much, much deeper into kind of like what was behind it, like the presuppositions and all that.
That's awesome.
I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And they would say, oh, he's avoiding the question. No, he was not avoiding any question.
He was being very kind to you.
Yes, he was getting at the root.
Yeah.
Steel manning the argument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I also had great admiration in those years for Joseph Ratzinger, who I would imagine all the listeners know it's Benedict XVI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, God rest him. God rest him and speed him home.
Yeah.
You know Father Charles Connor, Father Charles P.
Yes.
Connor. Yeah.
We mentioned him a lot on the show.
He's a character
we
of himself.
Yes.
But he's a good priest.
And, yes, he is.
Church historian, right?
Yes.
Church historian.
Loved his classes.
So in one of our classes with him, he sort of took a little bit of a break from the lecture and asked us the question of, you know, it was, I think it was more of a contemporary history of the church, like more recent history. And he got to this period in like the 90s, must have been in sort of in the wake of Pastoris Dabo Vobis and John Paul II, his pontificate. And he started making mention of that sort of phenomenon of priests calling themselves JP2 generation priests. And he says, he asks us, you know, it's like, obviously you guys are going to be ordained under Francis, but sort of what do you consider to be who do you consider to sort of be your father? Would you say, I mean, John Paul II was so huge, right? He was such a big, I mean, larger than life. Oh. And then like Ratzinger is like the appropriate, like epilogue to John Paul II's pontificate. And so it's like, there's just so much there. He was asking us, what do you consider us to consider yourselves to be? And I'm like, well, I guess we still got to sort of be JP2 generation. I don't know how you're not still. Or either that or like sort of the, you know, Ratzingerians, if you want to call us something else that's new, right? Uh-huh. Like, because there's so much that's still being opened up and poured out. And
well, he was such a young pope, and there was, and I don't know if the guy ever slept, the amount he's written and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean,
amazing.
I was blown away.
And then for Pope Benedict to come to follow him, and like I said, we're still sort of still opening his books and still learning from both these two big men.
I have nearly finished Introduction to Christianity. I have 20 pages left.
Right.
Oh, what a masterpiece. Oh. I remember. Yeah, yeah, I remember when I first read that. I was in college.
Oh.
And
it's amazing. And he's so... It's again, I'm going to be at a loss for words, but yeah, it's so brilliant and it's so humble at the same time. Like you get the author comes through in the pages, which is an amazing thing. Since it's a theological work, you'd think it'd be actually kind of dry, but anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. No, I mean, we've been so blessed. I mean, yeah. I just think those years, I mean, what a blessing. And I mean, definitely formative for me throughout priesthood and episcopacy too. I would say I even learned to, after Joseph Ratzinger became Pope, even though I really benefited so much, I did even get more into him with his homilies. I mean, even, I'd love to see published just his, I mean, some are published, but there's so many of his, especially his homilies as Pope. Mm. I mean, magnificent.
I wonder if that'll be included. You know, they're doing like a collection of his works.
I saw that.
Yeah, that's like a 16-volume thing. Yeah, I think there's only like one volume that's been translated in English so far. But it's. But I wonder if some part of that will be.
I hope so.
And I really want to know, did he write after his resignation?
Yeah.
That's what I want to know,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I do, too. I mean, he had that. There was the one book was... The Last Testament or something like
right,
that.
Right,
From the Depths of Our
Hearts.
It was
an interview or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't remember who it was with. Was it with Seawald?
I think it was with Seawald.
Okay, it was his biographer.
Again, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I would love to know if he had just deep insight from his prayer and things like that.
Right.
An incredible human being.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I don't remember who was saying it, but it was something to the order of, I mean, for decades, we will be continuing to be taught by the late Pope Benedict. So.
And I get asked by people, especially more recently after his death, like, they'll say, Bishop, what do you recommend? And I thought, well, it's so hard to say, but I probably would say the trilogy, Jesus of Nazareth.
I would agree.
I think would be what such a masterpiece.
I think I would tack on to that the Spirit of the Liturgy.
Spirit of the Liturgy.
It's just another
introduction to Christianity. Yeah. It's
it's hard to go so many directions.
But you know what else? His Wednesday audience talks. The ones on the fathers and doctors of the church and on holy women, on these all these saints. I mean, not only does he talk about the saints, but you see his theology coming through in those talks. And I mean, help us to realize the richness of our tradition by reading.
Yeah.
And even his book on, you know, his audience talks on the 12 apostles. And then a whole series on St. Paul. Mm-hmm. I mean, his Wednesday audiences as Pope, that's a treasure right there.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I have a bunch of the volumes from our Sunday Visitor of these different Wednesday audiences. They're worth it. So, okay, we're just over an hour, but I do have the question. That's okay.
And I have a question too, but you go first.
Okay, well, I did. and also, my computer just told me that we're getting to the point of low battery, but we should be okay. We should be okay.
Just
the question is... What would you like to see happen out of the Eucharistic revival? What would be like this was totally worth it, you know, to do it this way?
Well, increased mass attendance, especially Sunday mass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been declining for 5 decades. I'd like to see that reversed. Number two, but that's not going to happen if people think the Eucharist is only a symbol. Mm-hmm. So we need to, really... And this comes with catechesis, education, et cetera, as well, about the truth about the Eucharist, the mystery of the Eucharist, why I gave those, you know, these two conferences, diocesan conferences on the mystery of the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. So we need, I would like to see, you know, a revival of true faith in the mystery as a sacrifice, the real presence of Christ. And also I would say... The way the liturgy is celebrated has an effect on faith as well. So the importance of the Mass being not just on the part of the priest, but on everyone involved, the dignity, the reverence, the devotion, the quality of the music, all of that, so that the beauty and sacredness of a liturgy is, because that does affect faith. So I don't know if I'm giving too many answers to that.
But I mean, it's
You can say great. Whatever you want on this good. Show, Bishop.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's perfect. Okay. That's great. Beautiful. Thank you.
This is going to bounce back sort of to how we began the whole conversation. But again, like the concept of fatherhood and playing off of what you just said, again, like one of the best memories I have of my dad was when he taught me what the Eucharist was. That's how I learned my devotion, when I was on my knees next to him on a kneeler, and he explained to me as the priest was elevating the host, that wasn't bread, that was Jesus. And then he held up the chalice. He said, now that's Jesus's blood. It's been with me my entire life. Yeah. Now, mind you, your experiences with your father are different.
Right.
But like, what's the best memory you have of your dad?
Wow. That's, you know, my best memory is when my mother was dying, which was a really tough time. I mean, she was diagnosed with gallbladder cancer, and it was on December 8th, 1993, when she had surgery and they discovered this and that it was inoperable and, you know, that, you know, it was, but it, that very same, and it was December 8th, the feast of Our Lady's Immaculate Conception. So a day of deep sadness, but at the same time, my sister went into labor and gave birth to my niece, Molly.
Oh, wow. Oh,
which was a blessing in my mom's last year of life with the baby.
Oh, wow.
But that year, my father's loving care for my mother was just, I think that's my best memory of my father. Mm. I mean, not that I have good memories from early on, but that was, I mean, his, I mean, I saw how deep that love was. Mm. And he was crushed. I mean, after my mom's death, it was really hard on him. But that was, you know, you hear the thing that the best thing your father can do for you is his love for
your mother.
Mm-hmm. And that was just, you know,
on display. Yeah. On display.
And then they say that, you know, sorrow is only immediately adjacent to love, you know,
right,
in that situation. So, yeah.
Thank you, Bishop.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys. That hour went by fast. I didn't even know we went above an hour.
See, that's why we usually, we told our listeners early on when we started this show, it'll be 45 minutes. And then we just get going.
I knew it wasn't going
to
be.
No. Well, that's because Father Stephen wanted to talk about beer at the beginning. That's what put us over the top.
You know, some people like your banter at the beginning. Other people do not.
Bishop, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a blast.
Oh, you're welcome, Father Dan, Father Stephen. Thank you.
You're welcome on.
God bless you both.
Anytime. Hope to have you on again. Honestly.
Sure.
We're at your service.
And so,
want to have him say the catchphrase?
I mean, we'll prompt him with it. I'm Father Dan Kale. That's Father Stephen Felicia. This is Bishop Kevin Rhodes. Thank you again, Bishop. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and anywhere you listen to podcasts. Email us at deusvultpodcast@gmail.com. God bless you. And as always, Bishop, say Deus Vult.
Deus Vult.